Hey, this is Miles Fisher, and you're listening to Coffee with the Greats. Today we're speaking with John Chambers, the former CEO of Cisco Systems, and one of the most respected business leaders in the world. John's professional track record is almost absurd. In his first 10 years leading Cisco Systems, he made 10,000 employees millionaires. After that, the returns got even more impressive. John shares with us some incredible life stories and reveals what he believes the currency of leadership really is. But as with all guests on this modest program, we try to go beyond the business maxims. Our last conversation with the Winklevoss brothers made for a bit of a breakthrough with this podcast. By speaking sincerely about mental health on very personal terms, we got more positive feedback from you all, our listeners, than ever before. It's all really touching, in one case, even life-saving. For today's episode, it was actually John's office who reached out to us to set this conversation. That's in part because despite his profound business success, John kept a secret for decades. He's dyslexic. As he explains it, dyslexic minds don't think in a linear way, but rather jump from A to B to Z. John talks about his own struggles with the condition and shares why old stigmas need to be smashed. As our audience continues to grow, I just want to thank each of you for listening and reaching out and for sharing this with your friends. It's the only way we grow. Our next guest is an absolutely extraordinary lady and the first of many female guests on our program. Yes, we hear you and agree. This is overdue. Really exciting things to come. But for today, you're in for a treat in hearing the wisdom and mission of a truly remarkable man. So brew up a fresh cup of coffee and enjoy another great episode of Coffee with the Greats with Mr. John Chambers.
I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. My parents were both out of West Virginia. They were up in Case Western Reserve in the med school. Probably, Miles, I was surprised because you normally don't have a baby during your med school because it's so intense. I never asked my parents that, but I was honored to have two doctors as parents. One of them was OBGYN, and he delivered 6,000 babies. And my mom was internal medicine and psychiatry. So when we broke, they could fix it. And there are two of my role models in life. I've been very fortunate to have them as parents.
Did you have siblings, older or younger?
Yeah, I had two siblings, both of them younger, two sisters that were very close as a family. We text every day. Our parents, really in hindsight, developed us without us even knowing that they did in terms of confidence and direction. Interestingly enough, all three of us are either a CEO or married to a CEO of a company. So my one brother-in-law, CEO of a number of pharmaceutical companies and startups, my other brother-in-law is head of the North Carolina healthcare system, university healthcare system.
So you were driven to accomplishment, or you were imbued with?
You know, interestingly enough, not really. What my parents taught me is they said education was the equalizer in life. And it was understood from the beginning that we wouldn't just get a college degree, that you would go beyond that. And our family had for generations on it. And you had to be in the right place with the right education to really achieve. And I think my parents never had pressure on me about overachieving. They just wanted me to get a good education. And then within reason, what I did in life, they were okay with. It was hard following two very successful people. My dad put together the concept of the healthcare system in West Virginia, moving it to the centers, to the capital city, working with the universities and putting seven of the hospitals together. Unusual for a doctor to be a good business person, but yet he was very good in that. And he did hotel chains, and I learned from him on that. He did community build outs of housing developments. And mom taught me the emotional side. She never let me go to bed mad at night. And it's a wasted emotion, which, by the way, I agree it is. But she taught me the emotion. How do you connect?
Could you describe just paint a little bit of a picture just in your youth at the time of West Virginia? Because as I understand, you had more millionaires in the state than, you know, all of United Kingdom, 120,000 coal miners.
Yes.
I understand West Virginia was an extraordinarily prosperous state in your youth.
It was. And Miles, you nailed it. The numbers are exactly right on it. We were an extremely successful state and a very well-to-do state, and one that produced an amazing number of Rhodes Scholars and launching rocket ships to the moon and things of that type, and great aviators. But we lost it because we failed to change. And we took it for granted. We had 6,000 of the top chemical engineers in the world, and our whole chemical industry left. And we had 120,000 coal miners, well paid. And now it's 25,000 coal miners that mine more coal than the 125,000 did. And so I learned early on what it was unique about growing up in the environment where the world was the tiger, and it was there in West Virginia and Charleston. And, you know, Jerry West is a basketball player. I got to watch him go down and watch him shoot baskets in the neighborhood when I was about 6 years old, and watched him be a tremendous player. I got to see the valley where people dreamed big dreams and they made it happen on it. And then it carried over later in life because my parents taught me that West Virginia wasn't changing, and they Richard Lurie almost prepared all of us kids to leave the state, which unfortunately we did, because there was not the economic future or the job future. I then saw what happened when an organization doesn't reinvent themselves with IBM, a great company. I learned a lot from them, but they didn't change when the mini computer came and the PC came and client server and the internet, et cetera. And I learned that a company only is successful if they continually reinvent themselves and disrupt themselves and build off of market transitions. I saw what happened to Boston 128, which was the Silicon Valley of the world. Richard, you know where I'm going.
Oh, yeah.
And there were over a million jobs lost. I mean, the Wangs, the Dex, the Data Generals, we were the Silicon Valley of the world. We knew it, but we didn't change. And Silicon Valley did. We thought those were the unusual California people. And they're all gone. And part of that was MIT. MIT did not work as effectively in the transition, nor did the companies, nor did the venture capital community. So I now understand that you disrupt or you get disrupted. And those are way more than just words. That the worst mistake you can make is continue to do the right thing too long.
Did you play any sports at school? And
I played all of them all the way through. Reasonably good baseball player, reasonably good swimmer, not too fast in track, intense connection, could throw the ball, football a long way. Basketball was my love on it. And I was competitive across the group as a whole, not great in any of them. I would have given anything to play Division I basketball as a guard. Wasn't quite at that level. Played
Jerry West, obviously, if you grew up with Jerry West.
Yeah, he is. And he was beyond me dreaming to match his skills. I think he was one of the best of all times, clearly.
He's also one of the coolest. I've been lucky to play golf with him. He was a member of my golf club out here. And of course, he recently passed, but just an extraordinary man. John, would you share with us a story? I've heard you once tell this remarkable story. I think you were 6 years old, fishing near fairly busy rapids with your father.
Yes.
Would you share that story with us?
Yeah, because it's an example when people ask me lessons learned and did your parents really influence your development and direction? Excuse me for 1 second. And so what it was, and I've told the story many times, is Dad and I, he was my best friend for many years. I lost him, Richard, about a year and a half ago, and I was lucky to have him for 90-some years in our world. But we were fishing, and he shared with me the dangers of rapids in West Virginia, and they're so powerful. And we were fishing in some pretty fast rapids, and he said, fish from the side, do not get out in the water, because this is a very dangerous section of the river, and you're only 6 years old. And he stood and watched me cast, and I had it down pretty well. And we were catching some fish. And so he moved further upstream a little bit to give me some space. And I did what any six-year-old might do. I kept pushing the envelope, getting closer to the edge, all of a sudden I was in the rapids and I was in trouble. And fear hits you, because the power of really amazing rapids is there's no way you can control your destiny in it. You're getting bounced off the rocks. You're getting pummeled. And I thought, I'm going to drown. And as I popped my head up above, my dad, I could see him running down the side of the river as fast as he could go, yelling, "Hold on to the fishing pole." And then I get back underneath the water and I poke up again. He was yelling at me to hold on to the fishing pole. Well, obviously, if he is worried about the fishing pole, he wasn't concerned that I was going to drown. So I took both hands, grabbed a hold of the fishing pole, just got plummeted down through the rapids, et cetera. And he got several hundred yards below me, swam out and pulled me in. And he said, do you know why I asked you to do that? And I said, "Dad, really, I don't. But I assumed you, the fishing pole was important. It was an ugly fishing pole, might have been $5 on it. But I felt it was important. You wanted to be sure." He said, "No, I wanted you focused on the fishing pole, not worried about where you're going to drown. Everybody gets into rapids in their life, and you can't swim against the tide. You can't swim against the rapids. You've got to go with it. Learn how to control your fear. Put your feet below, bounce through the rapids off the rocks, and then at the right time, work your way out." And he said, "That's your lesson for this." And Dad was always teaching me lessons, Richard, which is cool about you and your son working together. And then he did something I don't think he ever told Mom. He took me back out to the same spot, which is pretty dangerous. And he said, "I'd like to put you back in the water and you to do this yourself." And I'm a reasonably good swimmer, competitive at 6 years of age, and swam competitive for about 10 years. So I went for it. And boy, when I got out, there was a sense of confidence, but also the lesson learned. I learned how, for the rest of my life, to control my fears and focus on what you control or influence. Ironically, a very good high school athlete, about 12 years later, drowned in that exact same spot, turned out to be a good friend of one of my sisters. And we went to the visitation and I just stood in the back of the room. I didn't know him. And all of a sudden, the people parted in front of me. And boy, it was scary. He looked like me. And I thought that could have been me at a much younger age if my dad hadn't been there to remind me to hold on to the fishing pole. And nobody was there to remind this young man of that. And it shows you that no matter how powerful you were, and he was big and an athlete and swimmer, you can't fight against that. And if fear gets the better of you, that's probably the reason he drowned.
What would your mother have said if your dad told her that he put you in there twice?
It wouldn't have surprised her, but she would have gone, "Jack, what were you thinking?" And don't do it again.
Don't ever do that again.
In trouble for about a week.
John, I gather also just in your youth, something else to your parents' great credit is they recognized you had a problem reading when you were young and how they encouraged you to address it. I gather there was a woman named Mrs. Anderson who had a great effect on your youth. Would you tell us about kind of that journey?
I was actually dyslexic, but that was before anybody understood learning disabilities or dyslexia and understood the strengths, limitations of it. And it is one that when my parents saw as having trouble reading, and it was serious, dyslexics read right to left, not left to right. You lose track, you invert characters, etc. And my second grade teachers, I heard them talking one time, had doubts about would I even finish high school, much less go to college, given this issue that I was struggling with. I was great in math, but hopeless in reading and other areas. And my parents did what at that time was logical. They read with me every night and I'd read back, but all they were doing was grooving the wrong basketball stroke, the wrong swing stroke, and things did not improve. And so they didn't give up. They knew there was a teacher that helped kids that were struggling with reading and learning named Mrs. Anderson, and she worked with me for 2 years. She taught me how to adjust to the problem. It's like a baseball player that you're going to get a curve every single pitch thrown at you. Once you know it, you just take it to right field every time and you wait on it. And once I knew the problem, then I could wait on it. And then over time, I learned how to, and it was after the fact I realized it, take a weakness and make it a strength. So I go A, B, Z really easy. Most people go A, B, Z, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, all the way through. I can't think that way. So I picture all the the various elements, much like Richard, when you called me up and asked me about the economy when I was at Cisco, you were gathering data from a whole bunch of different points. And right. what my skill is that I can take this whole maze and I can connect the dots at a tremendous speed and go A, B, and jump to Z. Huh. And I always have somebody with me operationally that helps me on the detailed implementation of it. And so once I learned how to do that, it allowed me to make moves in business or in corporate social responsibility or changing society that perhaps others might not have the same skills on. And interestingly enough, a data point for you, about a third of CEOs are dyslexic. Most of them will never admit it. But if you're dyslexic, you know how they think and you can pick it up in the conversation. And I've done it probably 10 times where I'm talking to a CEO and I say, you're dyslexic. And they say, how do you know? And I said, it's your thought process on it. And I said, have you thought about sharing it? And they say, yes, I've thought about it. And the answer is no, because many people viewed it as a weakness. I ended up sharing it purely by mistake when, and take our children to work day, a young girl tried to ask a question in front of about 500 of her peers and came up to stage to ask it. And she couldn't get it out. She had it written out. And of course, under pressure, you revert even more toward not being able to read it well. And she went back crying to her seat and I followed her off the stage and forgot that I had my mic on, lavalier mic. And I just sat down beside her and her parent. And I said, tell me, what was your question? And she said, I'm dyslexic. And I said, I am too. And I said, here's how you handle it. Don't try to read the question because under pressure, you're going to mess it up. That's why dyslexics normally don't give speeches. They talk in concepts, but they won't read the speech. They'll lose track of where they are on it. And I said, I want you to come back up, ask me the question and talk to me about it. Don't try to memorize it. Just talk to me, much like you're talking to your parent. And she came up and she started to ask the question and the room was strangely quiet. And then I realized I'd come out of the closet about telling people what I thought was a weakness that would make me not be viewed as well by my employees at that time, 40,000 employees that I wanted to follow me into battle, that we were changing the world and we wanted to be, and we were the most valuable company of all times at one point in time. And I thought people would think less of it because of that. And it turned out to be the reverse. I probably never got more comments back about people saying, I see the human side of you, John. And what you did with the young girl was amazing. But also the fact that you had the courage to share that with us, because I know people who are dyslexic. Often some of the employees were and others. And so I learned at that time that to be a good leader, you've got to have a number of characteristics, and we can talk about that if you want. But one of them is that emotional connection that my mom taught me and the willingness to share with others the mistakes you made in life or perhaps the weaknesses you have. And I believe as a leader, you're as much a product of how you handled your setbacks and your challenges and your mistakes as you are of your successes. And I think, Richard, you'd probably agree with that.
I've made a lot of mistakes.
Me too. You tell me somebody that doesn't make mistakes, they're not taking enough risk, and you never achieve what's possible.
Before we get into Cisco, can you paint just a picture of Boston in the 80s, IBM? Okay. Tell us about kind of who was your mentor, so to speak, professionally at IBM as you were starting. And what was that world like in the late 80s? Because I know everything changed in 1991 when you started at Cisco.
IBM at that time was the equivalent of a Microsoft, a Google, Facebook, an Apple all combined. It was the dominant player, and it was dominant in information technology. And it had a machine like GE built with just leader after leader coming up through the organization. And there were a lot of stars, but the one that I looked up to the most was Chris Christie, a branch manager in Indianapolis. He literally ran his city as an IBM city, which the other branch managers did as well. They were like mini czars, if you will. And I didn't like technology. In fact, I had a number of offers out of school when I went to college for 9.5 years and got a bunch of degrees. And I had no intention of going into sales. And I didn't even like computers. And I interviewed there because one of my friends that I played a lot of basketball with in graduate school said, John, come up and interview. It'll make me look good in IBM. And we're supposed to attract people in. And I know you're not going to say yes to them, but it would help. And I said, Steve, I've I don't want to mislead people. I don't have an interest. And he said, I got two games to the basketball game that night. And I said, I'll be there. But Chris Christie, at the end of the day, I interviewed. And once I do something, I try to do it to the best of my ability. And a number of people were willing to not only take a risk, but make a pretty aggressive offer. But I wasn't going to accept it. And he said, you're not going to accept it. Why? And I said, I don't really like technology. And he said, let me show you what technology does to change business and how you, by showing customers how to do it, you can make a difference in their future. And it pays pretty well, too. And he showed me, and I ended up joining them that day. And it was my lowest offer initially. It turned out to be my best offer financially 1 and 2 years later, like he told me it would be. But because of him, he had a huge influence on me.
Hey, it's Miles. You know, this podcast is called Coffee with the Greats because I think we have pretty great guests. But also because I love coffee. I've been drinking it every morning of my adult life, and I've learned two things. One, you can't make fresh coffee from stale beans. And two, running out of coffee is a horrible way to start the day. So my buddy Remington and I, we created Bixby Coffee Roasters to deliver delicious, fresh roasted coffee right to your door. At Bixby, we're committed to sustainably sourcing only the highest quality Arabica coffee from remote farms around the world. We only roast in small batches, and we ship the same day you order to ensure it's always fresh. We created our coffee club to guarantee our fresh coffee is always in stock and on time at your home. And we hired the nicest people on planet Earth to handle customer service. We've got simple, light, medium, and dark roasts, but we also offer organic and single origin selections. We even make Keurig compatible pods, and our shipping is always free. The truth is, it's because of Bixby Coffee that I'm able to bring you these fantastic fireside chats with living legends. So if you're looking for a way to support the podcast, or if you want to upgrade your morning coffee and give Always Fresh a shot, just go to bixbycoffee.com. That's bixbycoffee.com. Thanks for your support.
You made the point earlier, and you just illustrated it in terms of the way you look at things. There are a lot of dyslexic CEOs.
Yes.
They tend to see the whole battlefield and the battle if they're successful. In other words,
yes.
They look at the entirety of the landscape, not just some little data point or focal point that they're being asked to look at the moment. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and we play out the whole landscape.
Right.
It goes into motion. We can see it, how that chess game plays out, how the battlefield plays out, how the transitions play out if we're taking on a competitor or we're trying to change a market or we're trying to do something that other people have not done, such as do acquisitions in high tech successfully, which nobody had done up into 1990, and we did 180 of them and rewrote the playbook. So it is that ability to see it all together and to see how it comes together and do the scenario planning quickly in your head as it evolves. Dyslexics can finish each other's sentences more often than not, because you can watch the thought process with it.
I've heard you share a story, and maybe we can transition into Cisco, but about when you decided it was your time to leave IBM, and you had a distinguished run there and a great trajectory, and you did everything proper. And as I heard you tell it once, you know, you expected the new job offers to come rolling in, and they didn't. And you started realizing, hey, I've got to promote myself, and I'm a little anxious now. Tell us about that chapter in your life.
Sure. Well, the chapter on IBM to Wang was actually a pretty easy transition. At IBM, I was very lucky and pretty successful and won a number of awards and saw the fast track. But IBM was starting to get very conservative, and the philosophy was do three things well, very well, and don't make mistakes. And I do 10 things and do 8 of them pretty well and 1 draw and 1 mistake. And the leadership said, John, if you're going to be successful here, you need to do 3 well and not spread yourself so thin. And I just philosophically disagreed with that. I got a call literally the day after that interview from Wang and accepted the job at Wang Laboratories. When I left Wang 5 years later, I disagreed with the philosophy of where the company was going. And Dr. Wang, unfortunately, had died. He was the smartest man I've ever met in my life and a wonderful person overall. I thought I'd just send out my resume and wait for the offers to come in because it was a pretty good resume. And I sent out a couple hundred and I waited for the offers to come in. And you know the answer, none did. And then's when I realized that your currency as a leader is relationships, track record, and trust. And in the process of the next 60 days after going back home and said, Elaine, this is going to be harder than I thought making a job change because I did not feel I could look for one when I already had another one at the time. And the first 45 days were miserable. The next 60 days went extremely well. And I had 22 job offers or near job offers in process. 21 were through my networks and people. And I didn't develop relationships with people for that reason. It's just what I built, and I build strong relationships for life. But almost everyone was where a friend or somebody I'd work with recommended me. And then I got the door open because of that track record, the relationships and trust they have, and trust transference works well. So it was very humbling on the one hand. On the other hand, I would have never ended up at Cisco without that type of connections.
So George Shultz often said, trust is the coin of the realm.
An amazing man.
Yeah, an amazing human being. Unfortunately, no longer with us, but just a wonderful guy and a great leader and a great statesman. But drill down on this issue of trust and what it means to you. And because, you know, not everybody is trustworthy, John. And how do you view the importance of trust?
I think trust is at the core of everything in life. I think it is trust and your values that determine who you are. And sometimes people get opportunities that others do not, but it's how well you implement off of those. Over the years, I've probably sold to several hundred thousand customers. There's not a one that I'm aware of that I can't go back and sell to again, even at a CEO level, about here's what we could do together. Because when I committed something to them, if it was humanly possible to deliver on it, I would. And I never sold them anything I did not think they need. And that trust is something that is just ingrained in what I do. I'm not a perfect leader. I've made many mistakes, but I think most people would say my strengths are getting market transitions right, building great teams, and the relationships and trust that I have to make that come to life. So I think trust is at the core of almost who you are in life.
To bring us into Cisco, you know, just quickly for our audience, because we also have a young audience, the creation of Cisco is really tied root and branch, frankly, to the creation of the internet. This is initially a company that sprung from the mega brains at Stanford. You know, the core concept of here's a computer and there's a computer. Let's let them talk to each other. The kind of the core tenet of network building and the technology to build that unbelievable power being unleashed. Still a relatively small company. You joined in 91, roughly 400 employees. You came from super distinguished Big Blue and Wang in Boston. You moved to a place where coat and tie is no longer necessary. They give you, I think, literally a closet space for your introductory office.
Yes.
what was the internet in 1991?
Well, this is where you're a product of your life experiences. And I had a chance to join the top database companies, potentially as the number two, and some really big ones to become number one and other areas. And I didn't understand the internet very much. And when they explained it to me, they talked about it in technical terms, in nerds and techies talking to each other among universities and within the government, and zeros and ones moving around a high-speed network. And I knew what that represented. I immediately went back to Chris Christie teaching me about how do you use computers to change business. And I understood the implications on this. It wasn't about zeros or ones or techies communicating. It would change every aspect of people's lives. And so I joined Cisco, and it was a tremendous honor when there were 400 people, and we grew to 75,000 under my leadership. And from $70 million in sales to about $48 billion in sales. And if you invested a dollar with us, Richard, you'd made $15,000 off of each dollar you invested. So pretty good run. And we made 10,000 millionaires among our employees the first 10 years I was there alone, and did even better afterwards in total for it. But it was the ability to understand this was not about a techie sell. It was using technology to change our world. And this is one of the lessons learned for young people, is you try to get what are the transitions going on in your life, both personal and business, and you compete and focus on the transitions. And then you articulate it in ways that people get. So in simple terms, 1993, I was getting complaint letters about my truck drivers, i.e. Cisco food truck drivers, to my desk, because nobody knew what Cisco was. I was kind of frustrating on that. And I knew we'd arrive when I quit getting those letters. But it is the ability to take a very complex topic and express it in ways that people grasp. And this is the ability, back to communications. I forget which one of the two of you said, but a large part of leadership is multiple factors, one of which is how well you communicate, of which listening is as important as what you say. But taking the concept and saying that we were going to change the way the world works, lives, learns, and plays. The internet was synonymous with that, and Cisco was going to be synonymous with the internet. And even my marketing people hated it. But for me, it was so simple. I played that game out in my mind on where are we, what was possible. And you could see how this would change everything from the way you buy things to the way you communicate with others to it wouldn't be just data. It would be voice and video probably over time. And once we got that high level, then we started selling business outcomes to our companies, not selling technology in silos. You fast forward to 1998, a big market transition when we decided to make a huge push into service providers. I said at one of the key service provider conferences that voice was going to be free. And for many of you listeners today, you go, well, of course it is. But at that time, 90% of AT&T and Verizon's business, et cetera, was voice. And I said, their primary revenue stream and profits is going to be for free because it's going to ride on the back of the internet. It's going to require so little of the internet's highway that people who compete against these large companies will give it away. And if companies didn't transition to video, didn't transition to adding value on top of just voice, they're going to have an economic problem. Fast forward literally to 2011. And I said at that time, the world's going to go digital. I was a little bit even earlier on it than I was voice would be free. And people kind of looked at me sideways and saying, well, there's only 1,000 devices connected to the internet when you joined Cisco. There's a couple billion now. What do you mean a digital world? And to me, it was going to all come together connected, and it would change countries. And Prime Minister Modi's doing that in India. President Macron's doing that in France. It will change every business. It's going to be digital. And Richard, I think you and I would agree that was controversial 5 years ago. Now everybody agrees that we do. And it will change our lives. And yet I built our strategy at Cisco, making that transition that we call the transition on 2011, 2015. We all know the security issues are going on. We just shut down a major pipeline on the East Coast through a major ransomware hack. And it changed our economy. It changed our security system. It changed the price of gas, impacted a huge number of Americans in a way people didn't even grasp. A SolarWinds attack was probably $1 trillion plus damage in several months before. But back in literally 2015, at lecturing at the World Economic Forum, I said, when asked about security, I said, it's going to be one of the key enablers or key hurdles for the takeoff of the digital world, because there are only two type of companies in the world, those that know they've been hacked and those that don't know they've been hacked. And people kind of looked at me like your puppy dog does when you're talking to it. And the dog knows you're saying something important, but they're not sure what you want them to do. And they kind of turn their head like this. Well, today we grasp it. It is security in order to implement the digital age has to be an integral part of it. And the ability to see those transitions and then position your company or society to deal with them is what I love doing.
Is there a new generation of leadership that you see that is capable of handling this transition, or the extension of this transition?
You're asking a really complex question, probably with four or five different chapters to it. My parents taught me that each generation always has doubts about the generation that follows them, but the generation that follows them usually does a better job than the generation in front. So the answer is yes, we will develop that. I worry that in technology, the generation that I was a part of in the 90s and early 2000s, use America as an example. The vast majority of Americans felt that technology was good for them, good for our country, and that it was good for society. And we saw the economic results during the 90s of unprecedented economic growth of, what was it, 34% growth in GDP, 24 million jobs created, real per capita income per household went up, and it was balanced across the country, 24% during that time period. And as a whole, we were trusted, not just in our country, we were trusted in Russia and China as well. And the companies, while we competed aggressively, we came together on what's the benefit for society, and we formed groups like TechNet, et cetera, off of it. The current group is struggling a little bit. Again, this is why I believe the definition of capitalism in the future is you get good financial results and good for your shareholders, but you also treat your employees well and you bring a benefit to society. And the two together is where the strengths are going to occur. I think the large tech companies largely tripped on that in the last 5 or 6 years. I think you are going to see antitrust and regulation come because of that. And I hope that they get their act more together about how to benefit society and the legitimate needs of government and citizens and make it inclusive as opposed to operating in silos and not working together on goals. Do I think they will? Yes, I do. Or the next generation will on it. So I think in answer to your question, each generation, I think if we do it right in society and we give a good education and a chance to control your destiny, I think each generation will continue to get stronger.
I think that's one of the miracles of our country, by the way, and our form, our democracy. It's sloppy, it's dirty, makes mistakes, but with each succeeding generation, we do better.
I agree. But Richard, I worry most about not the society doing this. Our education system is broken in our country. We're non-competitive in the K-12.
Agreed.
Doesn't matter how good your colleges are, if you don't develop that core learning well, we aren't in the top, 40 nations in the world in our education system. And that's actually what I worry about most. I think if you get a good education, to our earlier points about lessons learned, then you're going to be fine in society. And all my parents wanted me to do is get a good education and then not do something stupid and get hurt. Yeah. Although I did several things stupid and got hurt, but that's a separate story for another time. So fixing our education system, I think, is the most important thing that our country needs to focus on.
Agreed. That's our Achilles tendon, our Achilles heel.
And with only less than 400 million people, you can't compete against countries that have over a billion that have a better education system.
To the point of, the changes with generations, and yet each succeeding generation rises to the occasion, as you're saying. What I worry is, I would just add to that, is I find with each successive generation in America, the incentives for our best leaders to run for public office continues to wane. I think that's a deeply entrenched problem. And everybody who's driven to this world, the only skill set is getting elected to office. It's not governing. But that's a whole nother world. You do spend a lot of time though, particularly in now your venture endeavors around young leaders, incredibly the emerging generation of the next star CEOs.
Yes.
Can you talk to us about how you bond? I know, for a long time you would take a annual trip to Alaska, you and kind of 10 or so budding all-stars. How did you structure that? How do you pass on the education that's not in lectures or textbooks or 10 years working at a company, but the nuance that is the differentiation between pretty good and superb?
So in the sequence and point it together for the outcome that you're after, I teach the young CEOs that they only have four things to do. It is vision and strategy for their company, to develop, recruit, and retain, and periodically change the leadership team to implement that, to culture and communications, culture is a key part of how you go forward. The reason I do the Alaska trips is it's a way to develop the culture in my team and forcing people to work together. It's a little bit self-selective who goes. I always paid for it myself, whether it was when I was at Cisco and take the Cisco execs, or now taking the young CEOs, taking a dozen of them, plus a dozen such as your dad, that can kind of teach them some of the mistakes made and lessons done. And there's nothing like flying out on a pontoon plane every morning to go fish any part of Alaska where you're probably not going to see anybody else. And when you see the grizzly bears there, they are not the ones that pose in the park with the picture with a fish in their mouth. I mean, these are the wild ones that don't see humans very often. You learn about people and you learn about yourself on that. And so it's a great chance really to teach culture and development. Out of the people that attended with me when I was at Cisco, I lost almost none of them. Our attrition rate at Cisco, voluntary people leaving, was 5% in an industry that averaged 15. And now my top executives, top, let's say, 100, which changed over time during the 20 years I was there, I might have only lost 5. So building relationships and culture and walking the talk is key. That doesn't mean it's the right way to do this. There, you can be successful as a leader in multiple ways. You can be a professional sports team up and out, and if you don't earn your right to the contract this next year, you're gone on it. Or you can be an extended family, which I clearly believe in, but that's not necessarily the right answer for a lot of people.
When you were in peak fighting shape, as it were, for CEO for 30 years, what time do you wake up? Are you a coffee guy? Do you work out in the mornings? What was important to do before you got into the office? What was your routine?
And what did you read and when?
My average day, if I were to look down through it, and my calendar is here, my notebooks are, here's an average day notebook on what's been done. I like to put physical notes on it. Here's my schedule with all the events, et cetera, on it. I probably do 8 to 15 sessions a day. I start in Europe, go through the U.S., end up in Asia. I love playing multiple chess games out. I start my day with a breakfast routine that I do not recommend to anyone. It's Diet Cokes and a donut.
That's the Warren Buffett school of dieting, I believe.
It might be. And I enjoy coaching. And back to your question on politics, you know, you've got to really care about society to go in politics. Those who've been kind enough to do it, God bless you. But most of my friends would never consider it, nor would I. I thought hard about doing it about 14 years ago, which is when I would have had to move if I was going to try to run for governor of California and then perhaps on a national basis. And there were a lot of friends who were pushing me to do it, but I don't like politics. I like Democrats and Republicans. I like inclusiveness on gender and color of skin and religion. I think we're all equal in life. So my average day is just doing now what I enjoy in life. And it's coaching young people. It's spending time with my family. My wife and I both love golf. Neither one of us are very good at it, but we really have fun with it. I have grandkids, which, as you know, Richard, are the weakness of the grandparents. You can spoil them completely. And it's fun watching your kids realize, hey, maybe my parents did a better job than I thought about developing us when they realize how hard this is. So that's my average day. It's a day that I love.
Well, I know you got to go. We appreciate your spending time with us, John. And we talked about this offline, but I want our listeners to know, when I was at the Federal Reserve, I would touch base with certain operating business leaders, not just theoreticians. And you had an enormous influence on the way I looked at the world. And you also had an influence on policy when I would report out, this is what John Chambers is thinking, what he's seeing. So I want to thank you for that. I know Miles and I, Miles, this has been a great session.
Oh, it's been great. Thanks for your time, John. If you're ever in Dallas or Los Angeles and just itching for a golf match, my father and I would both love to host.
Okay. You're going to give me a lot of strokes, and I will be in Dallas because Texas is becoming the next Silicon Valley. Yes. And it's fun to watch. So you all be safe, and it's an honor. I learned a lot today. I hope I gave back to your listeners as well.
Thanks for listening to another great episode of Coffee with the Greats. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to this podcast so that the next episode will appear magically on your phone when it comes out. And check out Bixby Coffee to discover a better way to brew at home. Use code GREATS for 30% off your first order and free shipping at bixbycoffee.com. BIXBYCoffee.com.